Hi, everybody. We're here today for the Build Alaska Legacy podcast. I'd like to welcome Mr. John Shively, who's speaking with us. My name's Ron Pitchler, and I'll be having a conversation with John today about himself and his history here in Alaska, which is quite a history. How you been doing, John? How's this summer been going?
Oh, it's been doing great, Ron. The weather wasn't the best we've ever had, but it's the sort of the Anchorage that I remember, where playing softball in the rain, and so.
There you go. That's right. And I grew up here in Anchorage, so I totally get that. Did you get a chance to get out and do any fishing, any fun stuff?
I did a little bit of fishing and managed to play a little bit of softball still.
Really? Playing softball down at 10th Avenue there?
No, out on the De La Vega fields. We have a team it's a co-ed team, and to be perfectly frank, it's an excuse to drink beer, not to win ball games.
It's good. It's good just to get out. Being out moving is a good thing for all of us, especially people that have been involved in this construction industry our whole lives. It's good to still be out moving and having fun. And Anchorage, we do have we are in the land of the midnight sun, so it's just nice to be able to get out in the evenings and enjoy ourselves. So that's good that you were able to do that. Myself, I met you years ago. My wife was a director there for Father Chuck Getty at St. Mary's Preschool, and you were working there. And you remember that? That was back. Gosh, I'm going to say my kids were just going to preschool at St. Mary's back in those days. That was quite a long time ago. But
yeah, I wasn't really working there. My wife and I volunteered as Sunday school teachers, and we did that for 14 years.
So. Yeah, no, I remember that. The kids sat in your Sunday school, and you guys did a wonderful job, and that was good. That was really good. Could you tell us a little bit about maybe some bio on yourself? How'd you your school, your education, and maybe a little bit of family history.
Sure. Well, I grew up in New York State, about 60 miles north of New York City on a dairy farm. Although we leased that out, my parents were both educators. Went to college at the University of North Carolina during the mid-60s. I had a very undistinguished academic career, which resulted in a degree in political science. But I was involved in the civil rights movement at that time.
And yeah, so I would think so. I mean, that was the height of the civil rights movement, right?
Yeah.
In North Carolina, no doubt.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You see what's going on today with people beating the tar out of each other. And, of course, the whole movement then was based on nonviolence, which is a hugely powerful tool and not always easy to do. I mean, there were times when you sort of say, do I really want to sit and take this? But you do. And so anyway, and about a month after I graduated, I got an invitation from the VISTA program, Volunteers in Service to America, to come to Alaska. I had been in a sociology class my senior year, and this woman came in and started talking about VISTA, and I really wasn't paying much attention, and then she mentioned Alaska. I'd never really thought about coming up here, but it just sort of intrigued me, and I applied, and they took me, and I arrived on my birthday in 1965 in Fairbanks, where they trained us 4 weeks on campus and 2 weeks out in the field. I was in a small community on the Yukon River called Beaver. Then I got stationed in Bethel, and then I got moved because of my political science degree. It's probably the only time in my whole career that the political science degree meant anything, but there was a young mayor in Yakutat who was trying to put a city government back together, whose name is Byron Mallott. And so I was transferred down there, and as Byron and I both say, they asked for help and got me instead, but we became very good friends, and of course it was right in the late 60s that the Alaska Federation of Natives was formed, so Byron got me involved in being interested in the native land issue, and then I went from Yakutat to Fairbanks to be a VISTA supervisor and traveled the Yukon and the northwest and northern part of Alaska. So, by the time I'd been here 3 years, I'd seen, southeast, a good part of some of the Kuskokwim Yukon, actually almost all of the Yukon and the Northwest, an experience that not a lot of new Alaskans get. And then I got recruited to write what became the grant for the first Native-run health corporations, which are now, economic engines in the state. as a result of somebody from the Office of Economic Opportunity, the head of their health division, thinking that they could do a program up here that both involved native control of health services, but also better training for the health aide, which were, you know, the front line of giving health care. And then Byron recruited me to go to work for him at RuralCap, where I served under him and then became executive director. And then from there, I went to the Alaska Federation of Natives, and then from there to NANA for about 7 or 8 years. Then on to work for Bill Sheffield as his chief of staff, and then
remember that.
Yeah, it didn't end all that well, but it was, you know, well, we accomplished some things, and then
it was sort of trying times for the state right through that.
Yeah,
period,
well,
that
particularly
time
at the end. Yeah,
yeah,
that was, you know, the mid-80s. The economy sort of faltered, or did falter a lot. I mean, and so I went back to NANA, but NANA was a part owner of one of the banks in town that was going under, and the FDIC wanted new management. So I went for, I don't know, about a little less than a year to run that while the FDIC closed it out. So it's my banking career.
Mm-hmm.
And then was with NANA again for a while. And then Tony Knowles recruited me to be Commissioner of Natural Resources. I did that for about 6 years, and then opened up a small consulting firm, Jade North, that still exists, and then on to Holland America, and then to Pebble.
Well, that's quite a bio there. Thanks for sharing. I do got a couple questions for you, though. You said you grew up in upstate New York there. Tell me where in upstate New York. The reason I say it is my family's from New York, Long Island, New York, Hempstead, and my son now lives in Buffalo, New York. He went on back east to graduate in college in Vermont on a hockey scholarship, and now he's decided to stay on the East Coast. He's working in Buffalo, New York right now. So where in upstate New York?
Well, it's a lot closer to the city, about 60 miles north of the city, town called Goshen. And
Is that around the Queens area, north of Queens?
No, well north of there. Yeah. It's Orange County. It's up the Hudson River ways.
Oh, okay.
And it's where my mother's family was. We're all from that area, and so we were close to them, and had, you know, lots of sort of family get-togethers as I was growing up.
Yeah. I know my grandmother, my father used to say there was a lot of ethnic neighborhoods back in those days, and it was they had a lot of fun. Of course, I grew up in Long Island.
Right.
And where JFK is today, mm-hmm. and it was a real rural area back there in the 30s. But that's cool that you were there. So tell me about Bethel in the 60s. I mean, I know what Bethel is mm-hmm. today, but you were in Bethel there right after you got here in Alaska.
Yeah, it was, you know, much smaller. I think there were probably, 6,000 or 7,000 people or more. I think then it was about a little over 1,000. For rural Alaska was a pretty good place because we had daily air service, and there were telephones there, which there weren't in the villages in those days, and electricity. So it wasn't a bad place to be stationed. I did a lot of work with youth when I was there.
And that's when the high school was there, right? A lot of the kids were shipped into the high school.
That was later for the regional high school. But I did, get to travel to some of the smaller villages. And I think a lot of people don't understand what Alaska was like in the 60s and even into the 70s. I mean, it was third world country. And the statistics were third world statistics, infant mortality, lifespan, all of that. And if you lived in a village, you had no telephone. There was no TV. If there was radio that you could get, it was either Armed Forces radio, or if you were close enough to a big city like Anchorage or Fairbanks, and there were a couple powerful stations. But and for the most part, there were no airfields. So it was the river. That was the runway, and which meant for, you know, a month or so in the spring and a month or so in the fall, you had no runway.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a much different place. No high schools in the villages in those days. So if you wanted to go to high school, you had to go out of the community. And when I came here, there weren't the regional high schools. You had to go, the closest you could go in terms of what the Bureau of Indian Affairs would do you was Sitka, which was, you know, a couple 1,000 1,200 miles or more, but you also could be sent to as far away as Oklahoma to high school. And so the high school kids had to leave home in September, and they wouldn't get back till summer.
Yeah, that's a great little synopsis there on Alaska history in that region for that time period. So, and you came up here right after the earthquake. I assume we were still reconstructing, so there was probably a lot of construction in the Anchorage and Fairbanks area. Fairbanks wasn't damaged by it, but anytime you went through the Anchorage International Airport, you had to see some construction going on.
Yeah, and we had training sessions in Anchorage and so here, and you know, there in 65 there was still a lot of evidence about some buildings, although most of the building stuff had been cleaned up. But yeah, I mean, and everybody was talking about what a boon it was to the Anchorage economy. You know, I mean, we didn't have a great economy in the early 60s. When, as like most people know, when we became a state, people didn't think we'd make it economically, which is one of the reasons we got such a big land grant from the federal government. But something like the earthquake brought in a lot of federal money, and it made a big difference in the economy here.
Yeah, yeah.
Good construction jobs are a very important part of an economy.
Yeah, I know both my father and my grandfather. My grandfather was a union carpenter in those days who came up during the war years to work on the military installations, and of course the earthquake helped them out tremendously. My dad worked for Matanuska Dairy, which had a big boom, right, you know, during that time frame, and same thing. It was good times after the earthquake there that helped out a lot. You were saying here that you worked with Byram a lot on the native land claims. Could you expound on that a little
Yeah,
bit?
Yeah, you know, he was mayor, and I was sort of like a city manager, that if you can, it's as close as we can get it. But you know, times were quiet in those days, and so we would have a lot of time to sit around and talk. And it was, you know, it was just about that time that Willie Hensley wrote his paper saying, "Look, there's a claim that natives have to land up here that's never been resolved." And so, you know, Byron and I chatted about that, and then in October of 1966, he said, you know, there's going to be this big meeting, statewide meeting of Alaska Natives in Anchorage, and he said, I think you're going to be in Anchorage the week before, you might want to stay, because this might be something. So I did. It was interesting because I was non-native. I didn't get into all the sessions, but it was that meeting that basically, out of that meeting grew the Alaska Federation of Natives and the push for the land settlement that actually was finalized in 1971. So, you know, he really got me interested in that issue. Was also interesting in that there was this great debate in the Vista management whether our Vista volunteers throughout the state, and you know, I ultimately became a supervisor, should be involved in this issue. And of course, being somewhat of a radical and civil rights guy, I said, well, what do you mean? Should we be involved? Why is it even a question? But Vista volunteers did help spread some of the information that people needed in the village, because there just really wasn't any way to get information around.
Yeah, that goes back to some interesting times there for the Native Lands Claims Act. So were there any, can you comment on any other historical things that happened? I know we had our oil boom out in Cook Inlet while you were here. You were in the midst of that when you came up here. We had the oil was discovered in Prudhoe Bay, and any involvement in any of that, those discoveries?
Well, not so much Cook Inlet. I mean, in those days, and people think that oil only paid its way after Prudhoe Bay, but Bill Egan, our first governor, balanced the budget based on oil and oil lease sales, but it was a much different budget. I think the year that Prudhoe Bay was discovered, our whole state budget was like $60 million, which
it's incredible.
Doesn't
isn't
really
it?
Fund the department today.
I know, it's crazy.
So I didn't have much for that, but I was here when oil was discovered at Prudhoe Bay, and here for the $900 million lease sale, which, I mean, really was a you know, a big deal for the state. I mean, when you say you've got a $60 to $70 million budget, and all of a sudden $900 million rolls in the door, it was a game changer. And then, of course, things sort of slowed down. I mean, first of all, once oil was discovered, people thought everything was going to happen the next day. And so, you know, if you, like Alaska Airlines at the time, went and bought hotels, newspapers, anything they could get their hands on, which almost bankrupted the paper, because, of course, it took the better part of a decade to get the pipeline, or actually a decade before between when Prudhoe was discovered and when oil started to flow, because you had to go through the environmental impact statement. There was litigation both from the environmentalists, which is pretty common, but there was also the litigation about native land rights. And really, I think it was the discovery of Prudhoe Bay that made it easier for that issue to get resolved, because the oil industry, although they took no stand about what kind of settlement there should be with natives, basically, I think, told the business community it needs to get settled. And I think that helped with Governor Egan and others and our congressional delegation to work to get a settlement in 1971.
Yeah, no, I recall those. My mother worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and retired there after 38 years. But some of her proudest times in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife was working on that environmental impact statement, that five-year period. And she said their office worked very, very, very hard. And back in those days, they were very busy trying to get that thing done, and which they did, and things came up. It was interesting, though. I remember being involved in it, because after the pipeline was built, our company, we were tasked with, there was a lot of problems with the, well, there was a concern with the porcupine caribou herd not, you know, being able to migrate on the North Slope, you know, to their calving grounds due to this pipeline.
Well, no, it wasn't porcupine, it was Central Arctic.
Central Arctic herd, excuse me. And anyway, they put all these little animal crossings in the pipeline, and there were issues with that, with the thawing of the permafrost, and where, you know, our drilling company went out and did a bunch of soil sampling and those, and they ended up replacing and fixing them all. But that was quite a time during there.
But, and, I mean, in addition, you know, I went to work for NANA in 75, that was just when the construction was starting. And NANA had a couple operations on the slope. They developed a security company, NANA Security, and they had security on the southern, I think it was the southern half of the line. It's one half of the line, I don't remember. And then we had a joint venture with Greyhound to do the catering at Sheep Creek. And that ultimately led NANA into a joint venture with a company called Manning's for catering on the North Slope after production. And NANA's been involved in that business ever since. And they also have been involved in security ever since. So, you know, that the pipeline lifted a lot of boats. I mean, certainly for people up here who wanted to work, I mean, the jobs were there. And you could work, you know, for 6 weeks or 6 months or whatever, and quit and turn around and come back in a month, and they'll take you right back. A lot of people, you know, did very well on the pipeline. They saved money for education, they bought a house, and of course other people didn't do so well with their money. but it was an amazing time. And,
yeah.
And then the state changed. I mean, you know, before that, you know, even though I'd only been here 5 years or so, you know, you'd go through the Anchorage Airport and you'd know a lot of the people. And then once the construction hit, I mean, it was just like
Anchorage boomed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did Fairbanks, for that matter.
Yeah. Anchorage and Fairbanks. Yeah. And of course, the state wasn't really collecting money then from production, but they did do a reserves tax, which was credited against eventual revenues from, and so that plus the $900 million helped carry the state over until oil actually flowed.
Did you ever have any involvement in the capital move back in the '80s? It sounded like you were involved in land. I just was wondering. We had voted to move the capital to Willow, I think,
right,
twice.
Well, we voted. Let's see, there were three things. We voted to move the capital. That was the first thing. And then we voted, then we picked Willow out of three potential sites. That was the next one. And then the third thing was to vote to spend the money. And that election was an interesting election. That was the election of 82, I believe. Yeah, 82. And so there were two things on the ballot. There was the, do we spend $2.8 billion to build a new capital? And do we repeal the state subsistence law? Well, of course, I was with Nana at the time, so, and I was very active in the subsistence campaign. But ultimately, we merged those two campaigns, the capital being more important to Southeast. But and it was an election that was interesting from the point of view that it's really the only election I think I've ever seen that I think was totally issue-driven. Because Bill Sheffield was opposed to the capital move and opposed to repealing the subsistence law, and Tom Fink took the other side of it. And I think you could have substituted, you know, Godzilla and King Kong for the two of those, and it, the way they were on the issues is what was going to determine the outcome of that election.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't have a lot to do with the capital move directly, but when we merged the two issue campaigns, we had a common goal.
Ah, well, that's good. That's a good little piece of history there also. Let's fast forward a little bit here. I know you've been working on, this is what I'm sure everybody wants to hear about. Maybe you can start, I'm sure you can take a break and have some water anytime you want, but please maybe inform us on the history, your history with the Pebble Mine, and maybe how things are looking for the future.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, my whole getting up here was serendipity, and most of my career has been serendipity, the fact that I got to go to Yakutat and meet Byron. So in July of 2007, I was at the Kenai Classic, and at the Kenai Classic, you get in a boat with three other people who you may or may not know, because in those days, Ted Stevens brought a lot of people from outside. And I was sitting in this boat with Ron Thiessen, who is the CEO of Northern Dynasty, who at the time was the sole owner of Pebble. So we were chatting, and I gave him some advice on things I thought they could do better. And I didn't think anything about it because I'd been at the Classic a number of times. And so you, that's what you do, chat. Well, apparently, for Ron, he said, got off the boat and said to himself, well, you know, if he knows so much, maybe he ought to run the thing. But they were in the middle of their negotiations with Anglo-American to form a partnership. So it was several months, and they came back to me. And I have to say, I was shocked that when I got offered the job. I mean, this is a multi-billion-dollar project. I have a degree in political science. And although, you know, I wasn't totally without some experience with mining, I was with Nana when we did the Red Dog deal, and of course, being Commissioner of Natural Resources, there were mining issues. This was something different, and so I got interviewed by both companies. I figured I could go to Vancouver, Northern Dynasty, I could probably slide by, but I figured I'm going to London, this is the big leagues, and they'll look at this me and say, wait a minute, let's get somebody else. But they didn't. So I started in April 2008. The prospect had been found in the 80s by a company called Cominco, and then Northern Dynasty had taken it over from them, and they had substantially expanded the resource from about 1 billion tons of resource to almost 10 billion tons, so which is why Anglo-American was interested. And, of course, actually, Northern Dynasty needed somebody of that size. It was found just there's this little sort of outcropping that's rust-colored, and a couple of geologists for Cominco were flying around with a local pilot and said, have you seen anything that's sort of out of ordinary? He said, well, I don't know, but there's this little outcropping here. Go look at that. So they got themselves down there, and they were actually looking more, I think, for gold, but which we actually, it turns out, do have a fair amount of, but it's the copper that really showed, and they did some of the usual sampling work, and dirt sampling, water sampling, showed the indication, so they went out and drilled, and it's there. It is, in terms of copper and gold, both probably the largest undeveloped projects for each of those minerals in the world today. So, you know, it's sort of like a Prudhoe Bay of mining, is one way to put it, in, of course, a very sensitive area. So when I was CEO, we were spending close to $100 million a year on a lot of it on environmental studies, on engineering, and drilling, of course, and then because of the kind of project it is and how controversial public relations. It was interesting. When I interviewed for the job, I told both Northern Dynasty and Anglo-American that if they were looking for a cheerleader for the project, they needed to find someone else. I said, basically, as a result of Red Dog, I knew what the economic impact, how positive it could be on people's lives in rural areas where there aren't a lot of economic opportunities. But I said, you know, Bristol Bay is a different area. And so I don't know enough to know whether we can do this in an environmentally responsible and safe manner. So, you know, a lot of my first year or so was just trying to figure that out. But, you know, I'm really convinced that we can do it. But first of all, we can't do the kind of damage our opposition says. I mean, people talk about us destroying the whole fishery or devastating the fishery. Well, first of all, there are 8 watersheds that feed that are part of the Bristol Bay fishery. We're at the top of 2 of them. So we couldn't wipe out the other 6, even if something went wrong. And we couldn't wipe out in the 2 drainages we're at. It's, what I like to say is that Bristol Bay, just the land area, not the water, the bay itself, but just the land area, is about the size of the state of Ohio, 23 million acres or so, and we'll use about 12,000. And so this idea that if something goes wrong, the fish go away, just is wrong. When I hired, when I became CEO, a guy named Ken Taylor, who I knew, he'd worked for the Department of Fish and Game, ran the Habitat Division, a longtime Fish and Game employee, and so he came to work for us, and he'd been there for a couple months or so, and he came to my office, and he said, well, he said, John, I didn't tell you I was going to do this, but I set out to see if we wanted to destroy the fishery, whether we could or not, and he said, we can't. And but, of course, in a project like Pebble, and with mining having, you know, a history that's not all that great, to be perfectly frank, although if you look at it in this state, it is pretty good. I mean, we've got 5 large hard rock mines that have not destroyed fishing habitat. As a matter of fact, have improved. A couple of them worked on improving it, both at Fort Knox and Fairbanks, where they took some old placer mining areas and redid it so that's now in a project with Fish and Game to restore habitat. And at Red Dog, when I first went to Red Dog, there were no fish right near the prospect because the mineralization was so high. And Cominco then rerouted the stream some, and now it has fish. So so the examples here are good. The technology now is good. The engineering is good. I mean, you have to adhere to it. So if you look couple of years ago now, there was a tailings dam failure in British Columbia at a mine called Mount Polly. And so, you know, people say, well, see, it doesn't work. Well, it's like anything else in life. It doesn't work if you don't do it right. So they had several things that went wrong in that tailings impoundment facility. First of all, they didn't build it the way it was designed. And the engineering firm that did the original design, all of them left the project because they said, you're not doing this right. But secondly, the tailings impoundment facilities are misunderstood. The opposition ran this ad saying there's this toxic tidal wave sitting behind it. And when you think of dam, you think of water. Well, actually what the tailings impoundment facility holds is dirt. With a little bit of water on top for management of dust and other things, but it's basically dirt. It's not this big water thing. But in the case of Mount Pauley, they couldn't get permission from the British Columbia government to discharge. So they had dirt, just like everybody else is going to have for tailings, but they had way too much water. And so it was bad management. Somebody, either the company itself or the government should have shut the operation down before that happened. So it is design, which we think we can do, and then it's management, and you know, government does have some responsibility there to make sure people are doing things correctly. The project itself is a major project. I mean, it'll be $4, $5, $6 billion project to construct, and somewhere between probably at least $750 million a year of direct economic impact once it's built. And of course, it's in Alaska, so there's no infrastructure. So you know, we need to construct the mine itself and all the facilities that go with it. But we also need a road. We need a port. We need some kind of power system, which will probably be based on natural gas, and whether it's LNG that we have to import because there's not enough gas here, or it's Cook Inlet gas, or it's North Slope gas, I don't know, but we will use gas. And that will allow us also to work with that region to see if we can't get cheaper power throughout the region. And we'll be bringing up in what we need. And the state has a power cost equalization program for rural Alaska where they help subsidize the high electricity costs out there, and so they could say if they can help with the new infrastructure, they can save a lot of money over time. We'll have literally hundreds of jobs, some highly skilled professionals with advanced degrees, but a lot of people that just can get jobs in just the maintenance and operations and then all the allied stuff we have, the logistics and that. And since we're on state land, we'll pay a state royalty that'll go into the permanent fund, some of which goes into the permanent fund. We'll pay, depends on how big the mine is, but we'll pay a significant amount of taxes. We may equal close to what the mining industry pays totally now and close to what the commercial fishing industry pays now. So, and that's to the state, and then we will have a significant impact on the local tax base. Of course, in the case of the Northwest Arctic, or in Red Dog, the Northwest Arctic Borough was formed as a result of Red Dog, and it operates almost totally off of Red Dog revenues. The Lake and Peninsula Borough already exists. They get most of their money out of commercial fishing, but this will be a major impact on that.
Can you comment on the politics of the region right there? I mean, we hear on the news constantly, about the Bristol Bay fisheries and how opposed they are to the Pebble Mine. And then we hear, on the flip side, we'll hear people from the locals actually on the pro side, looking for the jobs, wanting the jobs in the communities. And I understand that. I'm curious as to why we're not progressing faster.
It's interesting to me. Coming from Nana, where although mining was not something, in the early days of Nana, we thought we'd ever get into, and a lot of the people in the region had concerns, but Red Dog came along, and we worked hard to sort of make sure that, because it was on native land, we got to set some of the rules on how it was developed and brought the shareholders along and the villages to support that. Well, here it's a little different, because I said earlier it's on state land, so Bristol Bay Native Corporation doesn't have any direct economic interest in it. Also, unlike the Nana region really didn't have much else in terms of an economy, whereas the fishing industry is an economic engine out there. You can debate how much it impacts locally. I mean, things like almost 60% of the drift net permits are owned by people that don't live in the state. The processing jobs, you may have seen the story in the paper a couple, 3 weeks ago, how they couldn't recruit enough foreign workers to work there. Why do they recruit foreign workers? Well, the jobs aren't particularly good. They last 6, 8, 10 weeks. They're minimum wage jobs. They're not the kind of jobs you raise a family on. Unlike our jobs, which, of course, we don't have as many, but the average mining salary is $100,000 a year. But the Bristol Bay Native Corporation Board of Directors feels strongly that this is not a good project for their region. It's not unanimous on the board, but the majority is there. And it's a very emotional issue in that region. And if you want to say anything positive about Pebble, you can be attacked out there. Not physically, but certainly, vocally. And so the people that support us have generally been quiet. But our biggest support is by people that live closest to the mine site. Which is somewhat counterintuitive. So, but they have seen the impact. I mean, at the height of what we were doing with Anglo, we had 180 local people working for us. And, you know, it did change people's lives, even the short period of time we were there. And some people gained skills that they've now taken someplace else because we don't have the jobs right now. But so I think in the long, and we've been at a huge disadvantage. So our opposition can say anything they want about how bad it's going to be. And so, you know, they persuaded a lot of people that if anything goes wrong, the fishery goes away, which we've, as I said earlier, that's just not the case. So so they go out and get people, you know, you have to oppose us, you have to oppose us. We've never gone out and said, please support Pebble, because we've not put a plan out to the public. So how can you ask people to support something that they don't know what is? We have asked people to keep a more open mind, to wait until we do have a plan that they can look at, so that we can answer questions about, well, are you going to have a big mixing zone? The answer to that is no, we're not. How are you going to handle the pyrite, and how, you know, what kind of tailings impoundment facility? What is your water treatment system? And how will you impact fish habitat, and can you mitigate and make up for that? So those questions can be answered, and I really believe once we can start having that debate where people can say, well, you're going to destroy this because of A, and we're going to say, well, no, actually it's B, and it doesn't do that at all, that we can change the debate even out there and I think around the state.
Are you getting, with the new president here, President Trump, from the Washington, D.C. side of things, are you getting any support from them, or are they still pushing back on Pebble Mine, the EPA?
The whole thing has changed. Yeah. I mean, you know, the Obama administration and Lisa Jackson, who was the original administrator of EPA under President Obama, didn't like mining, period. I mean, and they particularly didn't like Pebble, but they did not like mining, and they did things nationally. You can talk to anybody in the national mining groups about what they did to basically make mining very, very difficult. And so one of the things when the new administration came in was, well, where can we create good jobs? Well, actually, natural resource development, like mining, creates good jobs. So you just had a total change in the frame of mind of people. And then Scott Pruitt, who became the new administrator for EPA, actually we had talked to when he was still Attorney General in Oklahoma, because we were going around the country trying to tell states what EPA was doing to us, which is trying to stop us before we had got to permitting, totally unprecedented. So what the Obama administration was trying to do to us, they could do to anybody. And so that the interest people that had mining and oil and gas development should be concerned about this. So he's familiar. So, you know, we had EPA stop because of a lawsuit, and a judge had put a preliminary injunction against them, told they had to stop their actions against us. And to get a preliminary injunction, the judge had to find that he thought we had a better than even chance of prevailing on the merits. It's a complicated case. I'm not going to go into it here, but that was a key thing for us. So we almost came to a settlement with the Obama administration on that litigation, but they backed away at the last minute. But when the new administration came in relatively short order, we were able to come to a settlement of the litigation, which takes them off of our back. They're now, the EPA had a proposed determination to set standards which they thought would stop us, had nothing to do with reality. It had based on a mine plan that was designed to fail, and they're in the process of withdrawing that, looking at withdrawing that proposed determination and just letting us get into permitting, like all projects. And so we'll be judged not just by one agency, EPA, but by, you know, all the federal and state agencies that could be involved.
Now, so you'll be, Pebble will be able to move forward with these groups.
Yeah, I mean, okay. We hope to be in permitting towards the end of the year. We're going to come out with a different design here, we hope, sometime in the next few weeks. It's a smaller footprint than we had talked about earlier, and some other environmental changes. And, you know, but we need a partner, just like Northern Dynasty needed it before. Anglo left in 2013, so we're working on that, and we hope to have that issue resolved also sometime in the next couple months.
Well, that's good news.
Well, that's quite a history there on Pebble Mine. So we as Alaskans have something good to look forward to here in maybe 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, well, I think
with
you know,
news
we'll have,
from Pebble Mine.
We hope to have some good news and to change the debate where we can really go out and say no. I mean, there have been easy things for us to say no. I mean, we have this one ad that I use sometimes when I speak that was a print ad from the Renewable Resources Coalition, which is something was an opposition group, and they show this nice river and it says not in this place, not at this time, and not this mine. So we use that and so. What we say is not in this place. Yeah, it's not in this nice river. It's in this tundra area, and we show a picture, and we say not at this time. We agreed with that because we weren't ready to come forward and start at that time, and not this mine. And what we say is, yeah, you guys design a mine to fail. We'll design a mine to succeed. So we've been able to counter a little bit of that, but not enough. But I really think when we have a plan, we will be able to say, no, you're just dead wrong. And we won't be saying it. There'll be an independent review by the agencies involved that will come to that conclusion.
Good. That's real good information for us all. I really thank you for all of that. What's the on to something else here? What's the future for Mr. John Shively? What are you looking at doing here in the near future? It sounds like you still got a plate full with dealing with the Pebble Mine, but you got anything else going on?
Well, I turned 70.
Congratulations!
Several years ago, 4 years ago, and my wife has been in Nebraska for a while. She is MS. We have a farm there. She does better on the farm, so we weren't spending a lot of time together. So after Anglo left, I chatted with Northern Dynasty and. Said, you know, I'd like to go to something half-time or, you know, consulting basis or something. Or, you know, if you don't find value, I mean, I understand that. But they gave me the position of chairman, and I basically have a half-time position. And we brought on Tom Collier, who is a Washington, D.C. lawyer, former, worked in both the Clinton and Carter administrations, was chief of staff to the Secretary of Interior Babbitt. So he had some Alaska experience. And we went to what I call our litigation phase, where we were fighting for our lives, litigating against EPA. And so he was a really good choice to come in and run the litigation. In fact, the case we got the preliminary injunction on, I mean, none of the rest of us would have figured out. It's a very arcane federal law that he knew because he'd been in federal government. So, you know, we have a good partnership. I mean, he is here a good part of the time, but has also had to spend a lot of his time back in Washington because of the litigation. And, you know, I'm sort of a public face for the project here. How long that's going to go on, I don't know. I turn 75 next summer, and, I love the state, and, you know, I'm going to try to stay involved one way or the other.
Are you spending your winters in Nebraska and your summers in Alaska or vice versa?
I'm back and forth.
Back and forth all the time, huh?
Yeah.
All right. What part of Nebraska?
Northeast Nebraska. So my wife has an organic farm there.
And oh, wow.
So we put in big gardens, which is my responsibility. She's busy canning right now.
So. Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, good deal. Well, I think we'll wrap this up. I really appreciate you coming in and talking to us today. And, yeah, I thank you.
Well, no, this has been great, Ron. I really thank you guys.
Yeah. No, okay. Good. Good deal.
Thank you for listening to the Alaska Works Podcast, brought to you by a generous contribution from the Construction Industry Progress Fund and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska.